Chapter 3, The Aims of Psychotherapy. It is generally agreed today that neuroses are functional psychic disturbances and are to be cured by psychic methods of treatment. But when we come to the questions of the formation of the neurosis and of the basic principles of therapy, all agreement ends, and we have to acknowledge that we have as yet no fully satisfactory conception of the nature of the neurosis, nor of the principles of treatment. While it is true that two trends or schools of thought have gained a special hearing, their teachings by no means exhaust the numerous divergent opinions that have come to be expressed in our time. There are also many nonpartisans who, amid the general conflict of opinion, have formulated their own views. If, therefore, we sought to paint a comprehensive picture of the situation, we should have to match upon our palette the subtle color gradations of the rainbow. I would gladly paint such a picture if it lay in my power, for I have always felt the need of comparing the numerous viewpoints. I have never succeeded in the long run in not giving divergent opinions their due. Such opinions could never arise, much less secure a following, if they did not correspond to some special disposition, some special character, some fundamental psychic experience that is more or less prevalent. If we were to exclude such opinions as simply wrong and worthless, we should be rejecting this particular disposition or this particular experience as a misinterpretation, that is, we should be doing violence to our own empirical material. The wide approval which greeted Freud's explanation of the neuroses in terms of sexual causation, and his view that the happenings in the psyche turn essentially upon infantile pleasure and its satisfaction, should be instructive to the psychologist. It shows him that this manner of thinking and feeling coincides with a relatively widespread tendency or spiritual current which, quite apart from Freud's theory, has appeared in other places, in other circumstances, in various minds, and in different forms. I should call it a manifestation of the collective psyche. Let me point first to the works of Havelock Ellis and Auguste Forel, and the contributors to Anthropophyteia, also to the attitude to sexuality in Anglo-Saxon countries during the post-Victorian period, as well as to the widespread discussion of sexual matters in general literature, which had already set in with the French realists. Freud is one of the exponents of a present-day psychic predisposition that has a special history of its own, but for obvious reasons, we cannot go into that history here. The approbation which Adler, no less than Freud, has met with on both sides of the ocean permits the same inference. It is undeniable that a great many people find satisfaction in explaining their troubles in terms of an urge to power arising from a sense of inferiority. Nor can it be disputed that this view accounts for actual psychic happenings which are not given their due in the Freudian system. I need hardly mention in detail the forces of the collective psyche and the social factors which underlie the Adlerian view and call for precisely this theoretical formulation. These matters are sufficiently obvious. It would be an unpardonable error to overlook the element of truth in both the Freudian and Adlerian viewpoints. But it would be no less unpardonable to take either of them as the sole truth. Both truths correspond to psychic realities. There are actual cases which, in the main, are best described and explained by one or other of the two theories. I can accuse neither of these investigators of error. On the contrary, I try to apply both hypotheses as far as possible because I fully accept their relative validity. It would certainly have never occurred to me to depart from Freud's path if I had not stumbled upon facts which forced me to modify his theory. And the same is true of my relation to the Adlerian viewpoint. It seems hardly necessary to add that I hold the truth of my own views to be equally relative and regard myself also as the exponent of a certain predisposition. It is in applied psychology, if anywhere, that today we should be modest and grant validity to a number of apparently contradictory opinions. For we are still far from having anything like a thorough knowledge of the human psyche, that most challenging field of scientific enquiry. For the present, we have merely more or less plausible opinions that defy reconciliation. When, therefore, I undertake to present my views in a general way, I hope I shall not be misunderstood, I am not recommending a novel truth. Still less am I heralding an ultimate gospel. I can speak only of attempts to throw light upon psychic facts that are obscure to me, or of efforts to overcome therapeutic difficulties. And it is just with this last question that I should like to begin, since it is here that we find the most pressing need for modifications. As is well known, one can get along for quite a time with an inadequate theory, but not with inadequate therapeutic methods. In my psychotherapeutic practice, covering nearly 30 years, I have met with a fair number of failures which were far more impressive to me than my successes. Almost anybody, from the primitive medicine man and the prayer healer up, can gain successes in psychotherapy. But the psychotherapist learns little or nothing from his successes. They mainly confirm him in his mistakes, while his failures, on the other hand, are priceless experiences in that they not only open up the way to a deeper truth, but force him to change his views and methods. I certainly recognize how much my work has been furthered by Freud and then by Adler. And whenever possible, I apply their standpoints to my practical treatment of patients. Nevertheless, I insist upon the fact that I have met with failures which I feel could have been avoided had I taken into consideration those empirical data which later forced me into modifications of their views. It is impossible to describe all the situations with which I was confronted, and I must content myself with singling out a few typical cases. It was with older patients that I had the greatest difficulties, that is, with persons over 40. In handling younger people, I generally find the familiar viewpoints of Freud and Adler applicable enough, for they offer a treatment which brings the patient to a certain level of adaptation and normality, apparently without leaving any disturbing after effects. With older people, according to my experience, this is often not the case. It seems to me that the elements of the psyche undergo in the course of life a very marked change, so much so that we may distinguish between a psychology of the morning of life and a psychology of its afternoon. As a rule, the life of a young person is characterized by a general unfolding and a striving towards concrete ends. His neurosis, if he develops one, can be traced to his hesitation or his shrinking back from this necessity. But the life of an older person is marked by a contraction of forces, by the affirmation of what has been achieved and the curtailment of further growth. His neurosis comes mainly from his clinging to a youthful attitude which is now out of season. Just as the youthful neurotic is afraid of life, so the older one shrinks back from death. What was a normal goal for the young man inevitably becomes a neurotic hindrance to the older person. In the case of the young neurotic, what was once a normal dependence on his parents inevitably becomes, through his hesitation to face the world, an incest relation which is inimical to life. It must be remembered that, despite all similarities, resistance, repression, transference, guiding fictions, and so forth, have one meaning when we find them in young people, while in older persons they have quite another. The aims of therapy should undoubtedly be modified to meet this fact. The age of the patient seems to me, therefore, a most important indicium. But there are also various indicia which we should note within the period of youth itself. Thus, according to my view, it is a blunder in technique to treat from the Freudian standpoint a patient of the type to whom the Adlerian psychology applies. That is, an unsuccessful person with an infantile need for self-assertion. Conversely, it would be a gross error to force the Adlerian viewpoint upon a successful man whose motives can be understood in terms of the pleasure principle. In doubtful cases, the resistances of the patient may serve as valuable signposts. I am inclined at the start to take deep-seated resistances seriously, strange as this may sound, for I am convinced that the doctor is not necessarily in a better position to know what is wanted than is the patient's own psychic constitution, which may be quite unconscious to the patient himself. This modesty on the part of the doctor is altogether appropriate in view of the situation today. Not only have we as yet no generally valid psychology, but what is more, the variety of psychic constitutions is untold, and there also exist more or less individual psyches which refuse to fit into any general scheme. As to this question of psychic constitution, it is well known that I postulate two different basic attitudes in accordance with the typical differences already suspected by many students of human nature, the extroverted and the introverted attitudes. These attitudes also I take to be important indicia, as likewise the predominance of a particular psychic function over other functions. The great variability of individual life necessitates constant modifications of theory, which are often applied by the doctor quite unconsciously, but which in principle do not at all coincide with his theoretical creed. While we are on this question of psychic constitution, I must not fail to point out that there are some people whose attitude is essentially spiritual, and others whose attitude is essentially materialistic. It must not be assumed that such an attitude is accidentally acquired or springs from some misunderstanding. These attitudes show themselves as ingrained passions which no criticism or persuasion can stamp out. There are even cases where an apparently outspoken materialism has its source in the denial of a religious disposition. Cases of the reverse type are better known today, although they are not more frequent than the others. These attitudes also are indicia which, in my opinion, ought not to be overlooked. When we use the word indicium, it might appear to mean, as in medical parlance generally, that this or that treatment is indicated. Perhaps this should be the case, but psychotherapy has assuredly reached no such degree of certainty, for which reason our indicia are unfortunately not much more than mere warnings against one-sidedness. The human psyche is highly equivocal. In every single case, we must consider the question whether an attitude or so-called habitus exists in its own right, or is perhaps only a compensation for the opposite. I must confess that I have so often been mistaken in this matter that in any concrete case I am at pains to avoid all theoretical presuppositions as to the structure of the neurosis and as to what the patient can and ought to do. As far as possible, I let pure experience decide the therapeutic aims. This may perhaps seem strange, because it is usually assumed that the therapist should have an aim. But it seems to me that in psychotherapy especially, it is advisable for the physician not to have too fixed a goal. He can scarcely know what is wanted better than do nature and the will to live of the sick person. The great decisions of human life have, as a rule, far more to do with the instincts and other mysterious unconscious factors than with conscious will and well-meaning reasonableness. The shoe that fits one person pinches another. There is no recipe for living that suits all cases. Each of us carries his own life form, an indeterminable form which cannot be superseded by any other. None of these considerations, of course, prevents our doing everything possible to make the lives of patients normal and reasonable. If this brings about a satisfactory result, then we can let it go at that. But if it is insufficient then, for better or for worse, the therapist must be guided by the data presented through the patient's unconscious. Here, we must follow nature as a guide, and the course the physician then adopts is less a question of treatment than of developing the creative possibilities that lie in the patient himself. What I have to say begins with the point where treatment ceases and development sets in. My contribution to psychotherapy is confined to those cases in which rational treatment yields no satisfactory results. The clinical material at my disposal is of a special nature. New cases are decidedly in the minority. Most of my patients have already gone through some form of psychotherapeutic treatment, usually with partial or negative results. About a third of my cases are suffering from no clinically definable neurosis, but from the senselessness and emptiness of their lives. It seems to me, however, that this can well be described as the general neurosis of our time. Fully two-thirds of my patients have passed middle age. It is difficult to treat patients of this particular kind by rational methods because they are in the main socially well-adapted individuals of considerable ability to whom normalization means nothing. As for so-called normal people, I am even worse off in their regard, for I have no ready-made life philosophy to hand out to them. In the majority of my cases, the resources of consciousness have been exhausted. The ordinary expression for this situation is, I am stuck. It is chiefly this fact that forces me to look for hidden possibilities, for I do not know what to say to the patient when he asks me, "What do you advise? What shall I do?" I do not know any better than he. I know only one thing, that when to my conscious outlook there is no possible way of going ahead, and I am therefore stuck, my unconscious will react to the unbearable standstill. This coming to a standstill is a psychic occurrence so often repeated in the evolution of mankind that it has become the theme of many a fairy tale and myth. We are told of the open sesame to the locked door, or of some helpful animal who finds the hidden way. We might put it in this way. Getting stuck is a typical event which, in the course of time, has evoked typical reactions and compensations. We may therefore expect with a certain degree of probability that something similar will appear in the reactions of the unconscious, as, for example, in dreams. In such cases, therefore, my attention is directed more particularly to dreams. This is not because I am tied to the notion that dreams must always be called to the rescue, or because I possess a mysterious dream theory which tells me how everything must shape itself, but quite simply from perplexity. I do not know where else to go for help, and so I try to find it in dreams. These at least present us with images pointing to something or other. And that is, at any rate, better than nothing. I have no theory about dreams. I do not know how dreams arise. I am altogether in doubt as to whether my way of handling dreams even deserves the name of method. I share all my readers' prejudices against dream interpretation as being the quintessence of uncertainty and arbitrariness. But on the other hand, I know that if we meditate on a dream sufficiently long and thoroughly, if we take it about with us and turn it over and over, something almost always comes of it. This something is, of course, not of such a kind that we can boast of its scientific nature or rationalize it, but it is a practical and important hint which shows the patient in what direction the unconscious is leading him. I even may not give first importance to the question whether our study of the dream gives a scientifically verifiable result. If I do this, I am following an exclusively personal aim, and one which is therefore autoerotic. I must content myself with the fact that the result means something to the patient and sets his life into motion again. I may allow myself only one criterion for the validity of my interpretation of the dream, and this is that it works. As for my scientific hobby, my desire to know why it is that the dream works, this I must reserve for my spare time. The contents of the initial dreams are infinitely varied. I mean those dreams which the patient relates to me at the beginning of the treatment. In many cases, they point directly to the past and bring to mind what is forgotten and lost to the personality. It is from these very losses that one-sidedness results, and this causes the standstill and consequent disorientation. In psychological terms, one-sidedness may lead to a sudden loss of libido. All our previous activities become uninteresting, even senseless, and the goals towards which we strove lose their value. What in one person is merely a passing mood may in another become a chronic condition. In these cases, it often happens that the other possibilities of development of the personality lie somewhere or other in the past, and no one, not even the patient, knows about them. But the dream may reveal the clue. In other cases, the dream points to present facts, as for example marriage or social position, which have never been consciously accepted as sources of problems and conflicts. These possibilities fall within the scope of rational explanation, and it is not difficult to make such initial dreams plausible. The real difficulty begins when dreams, as is often the case, do not point to anything tangible, especially when they show a kind of foreknowledge of the future. I do not mean that such dreams are necessarily prophetic, but that they anticipate or reconnoiter. Such dreams contain inklings of possibilities, and therefore can never be made plausible to an outsider. They are often not plausible even to me, and then I say to my patients, "I don't believe it, but follow up the clue." As I have said, the stimulating effect is the sole criterion, and it is by no means necessary that we should understand why such an effect takes place. This is especially true of dreams containing mythological images, which are sometimes incredibly strange and baffling. These dreams contain something like unconscious metaphysics. They are expressions of undifferentiated psychic activity, which may often contain the germs of conscious thought. In a long initial dream of one of my normal patients, the illness of his sister's child played an important part. She was a little girl of 2. Sometime before, this sister really had lost a boy through illness, but otherwise none of her children were ill. The image of the sick child in the dream at first proved baffling to him, undoubtedly because it in no way fitted in with the facts. Since there was no direct and close connection between the dreamer and his sister, he could find in this image little that was personal to him. Then suddenly it occurred to him that 2 years earlier he had taken up the study of occultism, and that it was this which had led him to psychology. The child was evidently his interest in the things of the psyche, an idea which I should never have hit upon of my own accord. Looked at from the side of theory, this dream image can mean anything or nothing. For that matter, does a thing or a fact ever mean anything in and of itself? We can only be sure that it is always the human being who interprets, that is, gives meaning to a fact. And that is the gist of the matter for psychology. It impressed the dreamer as a new and interesting idea that the study of occultism might have something sickly about it. Somehow the thought struck home, and this is the decisive point. The interpretation works. However, we may elect to account for its working. For the dreamer, this thought contained a criticism, and through it a certain change in attitude was brought about. By such slight changes, which one could never think out rationally, things begin to move, and the dead point is overcome. In commenting upon this example, I could say in a figure of speech that the dream meant that the occult studies of the dreamer had something sickly about them. And in this sense, I may also speak of unconscious metaphysics, if the dreamer is brought by his dream to this very thought. But I go still further. I not only give the patient an opportunity to see what occurs to him in connection with his dream, but I allow myself to do the same. I give him the benefit of my guesses and opinions. If, in doing this, I should open the door to so-called suggestion, I see no occasion for regret. It is well known that we are susceptible only to those suggestions with which we are already secretly in accord. No harm is done if now and then one goes astray in this riddle reading. Sooner or later, the psyche rejects the mistake, much as an organism does a foreign body. I need not try to prove that my dream interpretation is correct, which would be a somewhat hopeless undertaking, but must simply help the patient to find what it is that activates him. I was almost betrayed into saying what is actual. It is of especial importance for me to know as much as possible about primitive psychology, mythology, archaeology, and comparative religion, for the reason that these fields afford me priceless analogies with which I can enrich the associations of my patients. Working together, we are then able to find the apparently irrelevant full of meaning and vastly increase the effectiveness of the dream. Thus, to enter a realm of immediate experience is most stimulating for those who have done their utmost in the personal and rational spheres of life and yet have found no meaning and no satisfaction there. In this way, too, the matter of fact and the commonplace come to wear an altered countenance and even acquire a new glamour, for it all depends on how we look at things and not on how they are in themselves. The least of things with a meaning is worth more in life than the greatest of things without it. I do not think that I underestimate the risk of this undertaking. It is as if one began to build a bridge out into space. Indeed, one might even allege, as has often been done, that in following this procedure, the doctor and his patient are both together indulging in mere fantasies. And I do not consider this an objection, but quite to the point. I even make an effort to second the patient in his fantasies. Truth to tell, I have a very high opinion of fantasy. To me, it is actually the maternally creative side of the masculine spirit. When all is said and done, we are never proof against fantasy. It is true that there are worthless, inadequate, morbid, and unsatisfying fantasies whose sterile nature will quickly be recognized by every person endowed with common sense. But this, of course, proves nothing against the value of creative imagination. All the works of man have their origin in creative fantasy. What right have we, then, to depreciate imagination? In the ordinary course of things, fantasy does not easily go astray. It is too deep for that, and too closely bound up with the taproot of human and animal instinct. In surprising ways, it always writes itself again. The creative activity of the imagination frees man from his bondage to the nothing but, and liberates in him the spirit of play. As Schiller says, "Man is completely human only when he is playing." My aim is to bring about a psychic state in which my patient begins to experiment with his own nature, a state of fluidity, change, and growth, in which there is no longer anything eternally fixed and hopelessly petrified. It is, of course, only by stating its general principles that I can present my technique here. In handling a dream or a fantasy, I make it a rule never to go beyond the meaning which has an effect upon the patient. I merely strive in each case to make this meaning as conscious to him as possible, so that he can also become aware of its suprapersonal connections. This is important, for when something quite universal happens to a man, and he supposes it to be an experience peculiar to himself, then his attitude is obviously wrong, that is, too personal, and it tends to exclude him from human society. We require not only a present-day personal consciousness, but also a suprapersonal consciousness which is open to the sense of historical continuity. However far-fetched it may sound, experience shows that many neuroses are caused by the fact that people blind themselves to their own religious promptings because of a childish passion for rational enlightenment. The psychologist of today ought to realize once and for all that we are no longer dealing with questions of dogma and creed. A religious attitude is an element in psychic life whose importance can hardly be overrated. And it is precisely for the religious outlook that the sense of historical continuity is indispensable. To return to the question of my technique, I ask myself to what extent I am indebted to Freud. In any case, I learned it from Freud's method of free association, and I regard my technique as a further development of this method. As long as I help the patient to discover the effective elements in his dream, and as long as I try to show him the general meaning of his symbols, he is still, psychologically speaking, in a state of childhood. For the time being, he depends on his dreams, and is always asking himself whether the subsequent dream will give him new light or not. Moreover, he is dependent on my having ideas about his dreams and on my ability to increase his insight through my knowledge. Thus, he is still in an undesirably passive condition in which everything is uncertain and questionable. Neither he nor I know the journey's end. Often, it is not much more than a groping about in Egyptian darkness. In this condition, we must not expect any very marked effects, for the uncertainty is too great. Moreover, we constantly run the risk that what we have woven by day, the night will unravel. The danger is that nothing comes to pass, that nothing keeps its shape. It not infrequently happens in these circumstances that the patient has an especially colorful or curious dream, and says to me, "Do you know, if only I were a painter, I would make a picture of it." Or the dreams treat of photographs, of paintings, drawings, or illuminated manuscripts, or perhaps of the films. I have turned these hints to practical account, and I now urge my patients at such times actually to paint what they have seen in dream or fantasy. As a rule, I am met with the objection, "I am not a painter." To this I usually reply that neither are modern painters, for which very reason modern painting is absolutely free, and that it is anyhow not a question of the beautiful, but merely of the trouble one takes with the picture. How little my way of painting has to do with art, I saw recently in the case of a talented portraitist. She had to begin all over again with pitiably childish efforts, literally as if she had never had a brush in her hand. To paint what we see before us is a different matter from painting what we see within. Many of my more advanced patients, then, begin to paint. I can well understand that everyone will consider this an utterly futile sort of dilettantism. However, It must be remembered that we are speaking not of people who have still to prove their social usefulness, but of those who can no longer find significance in their value to society, and who have come upon the deeper and more dangerous question of the meaning of their individual lives. To be a particle in a mass has meaning and charm only for the man who has not yet advanced to that stage, but none for the man who has experienced it to satiety. The importance of individual life may always be denied by the educator whose pride it is to breed mass men. But any other person will sooner or later be driven to find this meaning for himself. Although from time to time my patients produce artistically beautiful creations, which might very well be shown in modern art exhibitions, I nevertheless treat them as wholly worthless according to the tests of serious art. It is even essential that no such value be allowed them, for otherwise my patients might imagine themselves to be artists, and this would spoil the good effects of the exercise. It is not a question of art, or rather it should not be a question of art, but of something more, something other than mere art, namely, the living effect upon the patient himself. The meaning of individual life, whose importance from the social standpoint is negligible, is here accorded the highest value, and for its sake the patient struggles to give form, however crude and childish, to the inexpressible. But why do I encourage patients to express themselves at a certain stage of development by means of brush, pencil, or pen? My purpose is the same here as in my handling of dreams. I wish to produce an effect. In the childish condition described above, the patient remains in a passive state, but now he begins to play an active part. At first, he puts on paper what has come to him in fantasy, and thereby gives it the status of a deliberate act. He not only talks about it, but he is actually doing something about it. Psychologically speaking, it is one thing for a person to have an interesting conversation with his doctor twice a week, the results of which hang somewhere or other in midair, and quite another thing to struggle for hours at a time with refractory brush and colors, and to produce in the end something which, at its face value, is perfectly senseless. Were his fantasy really senseless to him, the effort to paint it would be so irksome that he could scarcely be brought to perform this exercise a second time. But since his fantasy does not seem to him entirely senseless, his busying himself with it increases its effect upon him. Moreover, the effort to give visible form to the image enforces a study of it in all its parts, so that in this way its effects can be completely experienced. The discipline of drawing endows the fantasy with an element of reality, thus lending it greater weight and greater driving power. And actually, these crude pictures do produce effects which, I must admit, are rather difficult to describe. When a patient has seen once or twice how he is freed from a wretched state of mind by working at a symbolical picture, he will thenceforward turn to this means of release whenever things go badly with him. In this way, something invaluable is won, namely a growth of independence, a step towards psychological maturity. The patient can make himself creatively independent by this method, if I may call it such. He is no longer dependent on his dreams or on his doctor's knowledge, but can give form to his own inner experience by painting it. For what he paints are active fantasies. It is that which activates him, and that which is active within is himself. But not in the sense of his previous error, when he mistook his personal ego for the self. It is himself in a new sense, for his ego now appears as an object actuated by the life forces within. He strives to represent as fully as possible in his picture series that which works within him, only to discover in the end that it is the eternally unknown and alien, the hidden foundations of psychic life. I cannot possibly picture to you the extent to which these discoveries change a patient's standpoint and values, and how they shift the center of gravity of the personality. It is as though the ego were the earth, and it suddenly discovered that the sun, or the self, was the center of the planetary orbits and of the earth's orbit as well. But have we not always known all this to be so? I myself believe that we have always known it, but I may know about something with my head which the other man in me is far from knowing, and I may in fact live as though I did not know. Most of my patients knew the deeper truth, but he did not live it. And why did they not live it? Because of that bias which makes us all put the ego in the center of our lives. And this bias comes from the overvaluation of consciousness. It is highly important for a young person who is still unadapted and has as yet achieved nothing to shape the conscious ego as effectively as possible, that is, to educate the will. Unless he is positively a genius, he even may not believe in anything active within himself that is not identical with his will. He must feel himself a man of will, and he may safely depreciate everything else within him, or suppose it subject to his will, for without this illusion he can scarcely bring about a social adaptation. It is otherwise with the patient in the second half of life, who no longer needs to educate his conscious will, but who, to understand the meaning of his individual life, must learn to experience his own inner being. Social usefulness is no longer an aim for him, although he does not question its desirability. Fully aware as he is of the social importance of his creative activity, he looks upon it as a way of working out his own development and thus benefiting himself. This activity likewise frees him progressively from a morbid dependence, and he thus wins an inner firmness and a new trust in himself. These last achievements, in turn, serve to further the patient in his social existence. For an inwardly sound and self-confident person will be more adequate to his social tasks than one who is not on good terms with his unconscious. I have purposely avoided weighting down my essay with theory, for which reason many things must remain obscure and unexplained. But in order to make intelligible the pictures produced by my patients, certain theoretical points must at least be mentioned. A feature common to all these pictures is a primitive symbolism, which is conspicuous both in the drawing and in the coloring. The colors are usually quite barbaric in their intensity. Often, too, an archaic quality is present. These peculiarities point to the nature of the creative forces which have produced the pictures. They are non-rational, symbolistic currents in the evolution of man, and are so archaic that it is easy to draw parallels between them and similar manifestations in the fields of archaeology and comparative religion. We may therefore readily assume that these pictures originate chiefly in that realm of psychic life which I have called the collective unconscious. By this term, I designate an unconscious psychic activity present in all human beings, which not only gives rise to symbolical pictures today, but was the source of all similar products of the past. Such pictures spring from and satisfy a natural need. It is as if, through these pictures, we bring to expression that part of the psyche which reaches back into the primitive past and reconcile it with present-day consciousness, thus mitigating its disturbing effects upon the latter. It is true, I must add, that the mere execution of the pictures is not all that is required. It is necessary, besides, to have an intellectual and emotional understanding of them. They must be consciously integrated, made intelligible, and morally assimilated. We must subject them to a process of interpretation. But despite the fact that I have so often traveled this path with individual patients, I have not yet succeeded in making the process clearer to a wider circle and in working it up in a form suitable for publication. This has so far been accomplished only in a fragmentary way. The truth is, we are here on perfectly new ground, and a ripening of experience is the first requisite. For very important reasons, I should like to avoid overhasty conclusions. We are dealing with a region of psychic life outside consciousness, and our way of observing it is indirect. As yet, we do not know what depths we are trying to plumb. As I indicated above, it seems to me to be a question of some kind of centering process. For many pictures with patients feel to be decisive, point in this direction. It is a process which brings into being a new center of equilibrium, and it is as if the ego turned in an orbit round it. What the aim of this process may be remains at first obscure. We can only remark its important effect upon the conscious personality. From the fact that the change heightens the feeling for life and maintains the flow of life, we must conclude that a peculiar purposefulness is inherent in it. We might perhaps call this a new illusion. But what is illusion? By what criterion do we judge something to be an illusion? Does there exist for the psyche anything which we may call illusion? What we are pleased to call such may be for the psyche a most important factor of life, something as indispensable as oxygen for the organism, a psychic actuality of prime importance. Presumably, the psyche does not trouble itself about our categories of reality, and it would therefore be the better part of wisdom for us to say, everything that acts is actual. He who would fathom the psyche must not confuse it with consciousness, else he veils from his own sight the object he wishes to explore. On the contrary, to recognize the psyche, even, he must learn to see how it differs from consciousness. It is highly probable that what we call illusion is actual for the psyche, for which reason we cannot take psychic actuality to be commensurable with conscious actuality. To the psychologist, there is nothing more stupid than the standpoint of the missionary who pronounces the gods of the poor heathen to be illusions. But unfortunately, we keep blundering along in the same dogmatic way, as if what we call the real were not equally full of illusion. In psychic life, as everywhere in our experience, all things that act are actual, regardless of the names man chooses to bestow on them. To understand that these happenings have actuality, this is what is important to us, and not the attempt to give them one name instead of another. To the psyche, the spirit is no less the spirit, even though it be called sexuality. I must repeat that the various technical terms and the changes rung upon them never touch the essence of the process described above. It cannot be compassed by the rational concepts of consciousness any more than life itself. It is because they feel the whole force of this truth that my patients turn to symbolical expression. In the representation and interpretation of symbols, they find something more effective and adequate to their needs than rational explanations.